I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
Well, it's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again. You've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
Well, we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, bitch, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, introducing Mike Swanson. Of course, sponsor of this show, he wrote the great book, The War State, A History of the Rise of the New Right Military-Industrial Complex after World War II in the Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy years there for you. The War State. You'll really like it. It's great. And also, he gives investment advice at WallStreetWindow.com. And hi, Mike. It's good to talk to you. And it's been way too long since I talked to you and interviewed you. And how in the hell are you?
Oh, I'm doing good. Just like everyone else, I'm just watching the world kind of go crazy, watching our political system like implode or something on a monthly basis. At least that's what it feels like I'm watching. And we haven't really talked in a while. One of the reasons is when it comes to the financial markets, not a lot has really happened or, in my view, really been worth talking about for a while. And that started to change last year, and everything took a dump. Market fell 20%. And then recently, it's bouncing back up. And that's what has gotten everyone's attention in the financial world, at least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's my thing about it is that, the show is mostly an anti-war show and not so much trying to convert people to Austrian school economics, but it is extremely important to me. Lots of different aspects of it. But most importantly, I think, is the part of it, obviously the most important part of Austrian school economics doesn't require for other people to necessarily agree with any other aspect of libertarian theory in any way, to just understand that when the government serves as the backstop for the banks to expand the money supply, that that's what creates the essentially artificial booms that lead to the very real busts. And that's why we have these economic crashes every 10 or 12 years or so over and over again. And of course, the free market takes the rap, and more government regulation is always the only solution. And it happens over and over again. So I think it's really important for people to understand that. And it seems like you could have any political or economic philosophy and also accept just the reality of that and the way that that works. Deal with other implications later kind of thing, I think. So I'm always really interested in that. And I'm always really interested in, trying to figure out where we are on the scale. I know they created a lot of money to try to make up for the massive crash back in 2008 and the collapse of all the bad debt in the world, trillions of dollars worth back in 2008 and 9 and what have you. But so that just means, I don't know where we are on the scale here. So yeah, I guess the question is, like, how much of a correction was the recent crash compared to the reality, or say compared to 2008, something like that, so I can try to understand.
Well, I'll tell you about the stock that I'll answer that question first, then your earlier question, how does this, the economics, compare to the past. But the stock market action is just almost a blip, frankly. Last year in February, the Dow fell like 10% really quickly off the high. And this time, the markets fell 20% off their high. Now, I believe that what that action represents is the start of a bear market that will last for quite some time, 2 or 3 years. But when you have bear markets, you have rallies back up. And I think that's what's actually occurring. But if I'm right, that first drop is comparable to the fall of 2000. There was a decline that started that bear market. And that bear market lasted for 2 years. Then the 2008 situation, the stock market fell, kind of had a similar drop from October to January 2008, and then rallied in the summer, then it crashed in the fall. But those first drops in bear markets that go on for 2 or 3 years, they are kind of like the way this one played out. They happen, they catch people's attention, but they don't really scare that many people out of the stock market. People just tend, who are fully invested, they just hold and just think, oh, it's just temporary. And then you'll get the rally back up, which seems to be what's happening. And then they just get complacent again. But if this really is the type of bear market I think it is, what will happen is this rally, it could go a little bit more, a couple more weeks, maybe into April. But before the year's over, we'll be making new lows. We'll go below the December lows, and then that would be, you know, a sign that this is really going to last, and it's not just a correction. Most people think it's just a correction. on CNBC, for example, Jim Cramer this weekend said this drop 20% was a bear market. Now we're in a new bull market. It's just going to go up. And that's kind of the mentality of most stock market people, because they're fully invested in the market. But the bear markets kind of have a cycle to them. The way they play out, the first drop is denial, where people see it fall and just ignore it. And then as it goes on, they get more and more, people get more and more bearish and negative. So like in 2008, the market really fell for a year going into the crash of 2008, mm-hmm. and no one cared for the most part until it crashed in October. they were already losing 30-40% of their money, but then when it really fell real fast and all the bad news came out, they got scared. And one thing that happens in a big stock market bear cycle is they start out and you don't really know the cause of it. And then what happens is when it's over with and things get really, the market, you know, there's real panic and more fear going on. There will be negative news stories about what the real cause of this down cycle is. So in 2008, you know, the banks were bankrupt, for a year on their balance sheets. Those mortgage securities that caused the banks to go under, they were worth zero for a year, and no one cared. And you could find that out, that was going on. If you watched the movie The Big Short, they knew. And I had an inkling of this in the spring of 2008, that there are serious problems. People wrote about it. It's not I got secret information. But it wasn't until the crash that the bad news became widely known. In a certain sense, something sort of similar happened in 2000, in the sense that in the 2000-2003 bear market, the internet bubble bust, but the economy didn't really get into a recession except for the internet sector, Silicon Valley and so forth, until after 9/11. Mm-hmm. So it just takes, I guess another way to put this is when a big bear market starts, I think this is one, at the first part of it, it's only stocks that fall, and the economy itself usually doesn't slow down for another 6 to 12 months. And then the ultimate cause, like if there's really bad news, bad debts, or something lurking, doesn't show up till you get to the end. And then everyone kind of goes, oh no. So I'll say, what is the potential bad news and how does that, or debt problems, and how does that fit in of Austrian economics? It's kind of what you were going at first. When I first got interested in trading and investing it was in the late 90s, and Ron Paul is the fellow that got me interested in libertarianism and Austrian economics, because I was watching him on CNBC and C-SPAN question Alan Greenspan as this internet bubble was collapsing. And Paul would explain the cause of it, how the bubbles work, you know, to me and the view, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions, watching. And so I read Ludwig van Mises in some of their works of us other Austrian thinkers, and their basic idea is that the government and the Federal Reserve, they keep interest rates too low for too long. They misprice inflation. They can't perfectly control interest rates. So they tend to err on the side of creating inflation, creating too much money, which creates a misallocation of capital. And the internet stocks was such a clear example of this, the real estate bubble, another example of this. So we've experienced this. However, neither, as far as I know, Ron Paul nor Ludwig van Mises has had a theory of at what point does a bubble or the debt situation get so bad that it all blows up. And I want to tell the audience to refer to them to two works that are by economists, and one's by a giant fund manager. They're not necessarily, I don't know if they'd call themselves Austrian economics, but one of the books is called This Time is Different. And it came out after 2008. And what the authors did was look at like 1,000 years of financial history to figure out when does a bubble blow up? When does an economy blow up and the financial system blow up? And how long does it take to get out of the situation? And what's the commonality of all this? And what they found was that they looked at the current account deficit. And when it gets over 5% GDP, that's when a country tends to run into big trouble. So that happened in the United States around 2002, 2003. And the current account deficit it includes the trade deficit and the money a country borrows from other countries to finance its own government deficit or its trade deficit. It's really the current accounts, how much money as a percentage of GDP were borrowing from the rest of the world.
But at the time of the 99 bubble, that was when they were running at least a so-called surplus for the first time in forever, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So that was an internet. That was purely really the internet stocks that blew up. And it didn't necessarily or it didn't really affect the entire economy. It's more like a stock market bubble. Mm-hmm. And in a certain sense, the 87 crash could be seen as more of a financial stock market bubble, not one, you know, affecting the whole economy.
Right.
But their claim is that when you get to the 5% GDP point, what ends up happening is the banking system and the bond market starts to get into trouble. And that's what really causes in the end a real economic calamity. It's not necessarily.
And is that what precipitated the crash in 08?
Yeah, that's really what happened. It was the banking system. The government, the interest rates were so low that people started to go crazy buying houses, and people know that story. But the banks issued all these subprime loans that really shouldn't be given out, and if interest rates were higher, those loans never would have been made. And the problem was, it was something like 10% of the balance sheets on all the biggest banks in the country were in these loans that ended up being worth nothing.
Hey, y'all, here's how to help support the show. First of all, buy my book, Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan. It's available in paperback, Kindle, audiobook, and now in EPUB in all the different locations online there. You can get it, Fool's Errand. And also, really subscribe to the show. If you're not already a subscriber, there's an RSS button, iTunes, Stitcher, and all that stuff at scotthorton.org and also at libertarianinstitute.org. Two different feeds there are the same thing. And also, I got a YouTube channel, youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. Subscribe there and you'll get all the interviews. And check out my Patreon, patreon.com/ScottHortonShow. And you can find out all the details really at scotthorton.org/donate. Now, anybody donates $5 or more a month at Patreon or at PayPal will get keys to the Reddit room, r/ScottHortonShow. We got a great little Reddit group going on there if you want to join up. Anybody donates a one-off donation of $50 gets a signed book. And for $100, you can either get a QR code silver commodity disc, or you can get a lifetime subscription. For $100 to The Scott Horton Show, you get a lifetime subscription to Listen and Think audiobooks. And yes, we absolutely take PayPal and Bitcoin and all those things. So just go to scotthorton.org/donate. Also, the Amazon link is back at the top of the right-hand margin on the front of the page there. If you want to do all your Amazon shopping by way of my link, I'll get a kickback from their end of the sale. And hey, give me a good review on iTunes or Stitcher if you feel like it, or if you read the book on Amazon.com. And of course, share on social media, that kind of thing. And check me out at antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, kpfk.org, and libertarianinstitute.org. Now, so here's one thing, though, is first of all, I think just to clarify, you meant no slam on Ron Paul to say he has a theory of time, because that's what he says, is that in Austrian economics, I can tell you that it's going to bust, but I can't tell you when it's going to happen. But on the contrary, though, I actually talked with Ron Paul about this in the summer of 2008. I think as the campaign was winding down anyway or something like that. And I was asking him about, maybe it was a little earlier, but I was reading Gary North at LouRockwell.com. Mm-hmm. You know, I've always been more of an LRC guy than a Mises.org guy, just because I only got so many hours in the day. But so he was like a very educated Austrian school theory, gold money curmudgeon kind of a guy. And I like reading him. And he was constantly harping on the M1, M2, and M3 measure of the money supply, the checkbook money this and the different kind of securities that. And he was saying, look, there's massive deflation going on in the money supply. The bust is coming soon. Everybody get out. Everybody flee to New Zealand. Whatever. He didn't say that. But I'm just saying, he was saying the crashes are coming. And I remember asking Ron Paul about that and saying, look, we talk about the Fed and inflation all the time, of course. But right now, don't we have like a real collapse in the money supply? And he's saying, yeah, that Gary North is right about that. And times are tough. And then it was just 1 month later. I mean, this was in, you know, August of 2008, and then in September it crashed.
Well, and today they don't even report those numbers anymore.
Yeah. Well, but there must be like shadow M3 numbers, right?
Oh,
do you
are.
Look at those?
Yeah. And I don't, but I'm sure someone's got some out there.
So let me ask you about this. Do I even have it right? Because it seems like, you know, I'm, as an economist, I'm a great anti-war guy, to paraphrase Lou about someone else on a different topic. So it seems to me like there's a couple of paradoxes in the economy right now in terms of, I guess, government policy, where you have, on one hand, tariffs and higher interest rates anyway, relatively higher as the Fed keeps raising the overnight rate. And these are deflationary pressures on the economy, kind of, you know, pushing down on all of this stuff and possibly popping it. But then on the other hand, you have tax cuts and overall still artificially low interest rates, which both of those are still inflationary pressures and for the building up of the bubble. So I wonder how you think those balance out, or, you know, if it's even a contest or what. And I guess you're saying we're at the beginning of the end for this cycle anyway, but.
Yeah, I believe we're at the end of the cycle, because, and that's what I'm, you know, made these videos saying. That's the basic argument, is the stock market tops, the sign that it's in the cycle. But more important than that, as a real forecasting tool, is that interest rates, even though they've been raising interest rates, they do that on the 1 year, right? They manipulate the shorter term rates, the 1 year, 6 month, and so forth.
And the overnight rate is always a big indicator, right?
Right.
I mean, I love telling this story. I know a guy who, he built concrete skate parks for a living. A true hardcore skateboarder here in Texas, and owned this construction company building skate parks all across the West. And he read the Wall Street Journal every day. And as soon as they started raising the federal funds rate, that was when he sold all of his equipment and everything and went to, you know, weather the storm in semi-retirement until conditions were right again, and let somebody else take the loss on the, you know, unused bulldozer.
Well, that's the way to really know when the moment is that things are at the end is the Fed raises these short-term rates, but then you have 10-year bonds and 20-year bonds that people trade, and you know they have their own rate to them, and the Fed doesn't really influence them. And what'll happen at when you get to the end, those long-term rates stop going up, even though the Fed's raising rates, and you can get to a point where the 10-year bond is lower. The interest you'd buy for a 10-year bond is lower than what you get on 1 year. And that's called an inverted yield curve. What happens is the people buying these long-term bonds, they're forecasting a recession or at least saying the Fed's going to stop raising interest rates. And we're at that moment, basically, where these rates are just about even. So that's what makes me say and think that the market and the economy is at the end of this expansionary cycle. But with the tax cuts and the tariffs and all these other factors, I don't really – the tariffs is kind of – I don't really know how they're directly influencing the financial markets. I don't know what to point to make a claim one way or the other. But with the tax cuts, they certainly helped make the stock market go up last year, and it contributed to something that was already going on. Mm-hmm. So in 2013, the Federal Reserve started something called quantitative easing. They lowered rates to zero, mm-hmm. and then they wanted to keep stimulating things even more. They got scared we'd go into a recession or the stock market have another bear market, and they didn't want it to happen. So they basically started buying bonds, about $50 billion a month. Some of them were treasury bonds. Most of them were bonds from banks. But one reason they're doing this is we had a big trade deficit with China, and China was no longer buying enough government debt to finance our whole deficit. So the Fed, in a sense, stepped in there. But what this did was it lowered rates even more, in particular in the corporate bond market. And corporations, starting in 2013, started to borrow money by issuing bonds at low rates and buying back their stock. And then in 2016, the Fed accelerated this whole process, did another round of this quantitative easing, and the banks went on a complete lending or borrowing. I mean, not the banks, so the corporations, such as Apple, all of them that you can think of, just borrowed and borrowed and borrowed to buy their own shares off the stock exchange, and that helped make the stocks go up. And to give it two more real life examples that aren't just what's the stock market doing. If you take Tesla, the company Tesla, they don't turn a profit. And today they just announced they're laying off 10% of their workforce. And Netflix is another company. They don't turn a profit. And both these companies, though, have borrowed massive amounts of money by issuing junk bonds. I believe they're complete bubbles, both of them. And
Uber too. I read a great slam on that company's model.
No, I believe it. So, but I would assert that these companies wouldn't even exist if it wasn't for this quantitative easing program and that made the junk bond market create this opportunity for these people. And when Trump in the Congress did the tax cuts, they basically enabled these companies to do this even more. You know, cause now we're getting some money back, you know, that we didn't have before. So let's go out and buy more stocks. So last year saw a record number of share buybacks by corporate America. Mm-hmm. And that's been the real contributor to the economy instead of, you know, hiring people or building plants. In fact, in the last 3 months of last year, industrial production would have shrunk if it wasn't for military spending. So in some ways you could figure it out that almost half of the growth in industry since Trump has been elected has been due to an expansion in defense spending. And I'm not putting a judgment on it. I'm just trying to say that's what happened. So,
Same thing with the tax cuts. I know you're not slamming tax cuts in principle. Saying that's part of the landscape of this context of what's going on.
Well, I think the real problem, it's not so much that the tax. I think the real problem is that for whatever reason, our economy in our lifetime, and I believe it's gotten worse, there's some sort of structural problems with it. As far as getting really good jobs to people and raising wages and so forth. And I think it's been like this since the 70s for multiple reasons. And therefore, Trump or anyone else at this point, by simply lowering taxes, isn't enough to create the kind of boom we would all like to see. The problem isn't tax cuts. It's some sort of moldable. I mean, it's a whole nother conversation. Yeah. But
just within this conversation, because you're right, there's 100 different things to take into account. But just in this context, the boom and the bust cycle doesn't help. Where everybody who's like a mildly successful entrepreneur gets the rug pulled out from under them every decade or every dozen years. Hey guys, check out the bumpersticker.com and libertystickers.com. I created the company way back when, but I sold it to Rick McGinnis, and he's done such a great job keeping it going since then. They do great custom work for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com, and get anti-government propaganda for the back of your truck at libertystickers.com. Now, this time around, you're saying, you know, this is one correction of a cycle of corrections coming kind of thing. But are you really comparing this era now to 2008 or to 99? Like you said, 87 and 99, those really represented just bubbles in the stock market that were then corrected in the stock market, while the rest of the larger bubble, for example, in housing, continued on up until that massive structural collapse of everything in 2008. Is this going to be like that? I guess this is sort of part of the same question of just how much money was that QE, and how different was that monetary inflation after 2008 and the crisis of 2008 compared to, for example, the Greenspan bubble from 99 up until 2008?
Okay, yeah, that's the big question.
And I have Ron Paul up next, so he's going to be checking your work.
Good.
No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead. We're going to talk about Syria.
Okay, right now, the current account deficit is less than 3%. So that indicator is not at an alarming level. However, there's another indicator that is just as important. And I would tell people to look this book up, and it's free. It's called Big Debt Crises, and it's by Ray Dalio. It came out a couple months ago, and he does the same thing as the other authors. It's kind of like a reference book, the way it's written, but he's examining all the, you know, market movements of the past 100 years and when these debt problems blow up. And the indicator he looks at is the government debt to GDP, the debt to GDP of a country. That's the government debt plus public debt. And that, historically, when that gets above 100%, there's some sort of big problem. That's when governments run into trouble with their own debt. So this is what happened to Japan in the 90s.
Is this just a correlation, or you can really see why that is? That once there's three digits in the number, people panic, or what?
Well, what happens is
there's some kind of curve that says it'll never be paid off now. Is that it?
Yeah, well, here's the problem. Okay, so in Turkey, this just happened. And the crisis playing out there. In the United States, the last two times it happened was in 1929 and then after World War II, actually. And there was a big correction in the economy after World War II. People don't know it, but there was for like 2 years. And there was a deflationary cycle that took place. And in other countries, it was even worse. So actually, the Soviet Union devalued their currency by 90% after World War II, and England ended up having a big debt crisis. But what happens is when you get to the 100% point, it's not, and I don't think this is going to happen today or maybe even this year, but it makes a situation where people, there's a risk that this whole debt will never be paid off, not at the current, you know, it's just unsustainable. So the only, and especially if you get into a recession. So I think the big danger isn't today, but if the stock market is, you know, down 12 months from now and we have a recession, then I think we're likely to see the bond market go into a bear market, and this will be the big story in 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm. How's the housing bubble looking right now compared to the last time?
Well, the same sort of things have happened. We have seen in some,
I mean, you mentioned that movie, The Big Short. So people who have seen that have seen where they go to Miami, right? And there's McMansions everywhere and nobody's living in them and nobody's really paying for them. And they've all been essentially in default for more than a year now. And yet everybody's pretending it's still going on. You know about L.A. and Southern California and Las Vegas, where just becomes everybody's flipping like a Chinese ghost city. Nobody lives there, and the whole thing is just an investment, a short-term turnaround kind of almost pyramid scheme type of game that cannot last. Is this like that?
I don't think it's quite like that. However, in some markets, the real estate prices have, you know, gone up over the past couple of years, again, because interest rates were so low again. And they have actually come off over the past 6 months. And you see stories like, you know, they're not selling as many houses in New York City and so forth. But I don't really believe that, you know, there's a big bubble with widespread. Like, I don't think this, it's nowhere like it was, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, like a complete mania. I mean, I had relatives doing the, you know, flipping houses and doing all this stuff. And I don't think that's the, a big problem on bank balance sheets like it was back then. Mm-hmm. So, but, you know, definitely some areas of the country, the real estate prices did go back up.
I'm sorry if I'm getting away of your story with all of my kind of ridiculous side questions.
No. So
I'm trying to catch up on years of neglect of this issue. One thing that I think nobody ever answered for me, Mike, was maybe I never asked him. We used to hear all the time about, okay, they created all this QE money, but then, you know, they realized that they couldn't just dump all this currency into circulation, that it would cause massive price inflation across the board and it would be a massive destabilizing thing. So they came up with this ingenious policy for, I guess, the first time, where they would pay the banks a better interest rate to keep the money parked at the Fed. So in other words, they created enough money at everybody else's expense through, you know, the later price inflation, but although at a lower level, to keep all the banks whole and bailed out. In other words, a backdoor bailout of all of the banks to keep them from going under. But then at the same time, they paid the banks to not loan all that money out to, you know, regular schmucks, because that would cause, you know, the bubble to get too far out of control. But then I never heard chapter 2 or 3 of that story about what happened to that money, and if that's still the case, and when will it not be, and what is the deal with that?
Well, you're basically asking what happened in the past 5 years. I think is a way to put what you're saying.
Yeah, and hurry up and sum it up for me too, in a nutshell. No,
but I really think with the banks that program worked, and they basically, you know, got the bad debt off their balance sheets and kind of have stabilized themselves. But
and so then the central bank just sort of reabsorbed the remainder.
Yeah, basically. Okay. And that's what some of this quantitative easing stuff was. They were buying the bad debts that these banks had. So in one way, I mean, one crude way to, I think, this whole process is, in 2008, the banks were bankrupt and the government bailed them out and took what was a crisis for the banks and made it into a taxpayer or debt bailout, you know, through all these programs. I mean, Obama, when he got in office, the government deficit was $1 trillion, and much of it given that TARP program. But that program and these things did not make, you know, the day-to-day life of most Americans better, didn't provide bailouts to people who lost their homes or whatever. Not saying they should have got one either, but so we're left, you know, with watching the last election of Clinton and Trump, and, you know, that's why Trump won, I believe.
Yeah, well, that and some other things too, but yeah. All right, so now, you know, I don't want this. I don't think it has been any kind of infomercial, although I probably owe you a few of those for how generous you've been in helping to support the show all this time, Mike. So, I mean, I guess let me ask you, other than people going to Wall Street Window and signing up and getting your regular advice, just in the most general sense, how do people protect themselves from this kind of intervention in the economy and all the mispricing and all the corrections to come here? I mean, the short term or medium term.
I mean, this is what I tell people I know, you know, that live around, you know, friends of mine that, you know, aren't trying to trade the markets or something like I do. And honestly, I think the most important thing people in the stock market can do is not be 100% invested in the stock market. And it's common sense. But most investment advisors and the financial media will tell you be 100% invested, never get out because you might miss out. And I think that's bad advice. And
it seems like the only smart thing to do would be to bet against all of this stuff, all of these banks and all these tech companies.
It's
when I saw that Amazon is worth $1 trillion now, I thought, I wish I knew how to do one of those double blind short sell things, man, and screw them good. I could have made $1 billion last year betting against Amazon, right?
Yeah, well, it's gone up a little bit, but yeah, no, I mean, that's what I try to do. It's not as easy as it sounds. And, when you short stuff, you gotta be, you know, get out if you're wrong. Cause you can, you know, you can lose just more if something goes up from $10 to 100, that's a lot of money you lose. But the average person, you'd not be 100% invested in the stock market. But the other thing I think people need to do is own. So, I mean, that sound like a infomercial myself when I say this, but own some gold and silver, you know, because if this stuff blows up, then gold and silver will go up. I actually did a study myself going back like 30 years of financial data. And if someone had a third of their money in stocks, a third of their money in bonds, and a third of their money in gold starting like 30 years ago, they would beat the market anyway. And they only would have lost like 10% in 2008 because bonds and gold went up. The problem is there will be investment advisors that tell people, okay, we want to be more conservative, so put half your money in bonds and half your money in stocks, because historically bonds go up when the stock market falls, treasury bonds I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that is a good strategy. However, if my fear is correct that the U.S. is going to have a debt crisis, that strategy won't work. You'll need gold or silver. And so I think that's really what people should do. Put 10, 20% of their money in gold and silver, and whatever they do the rest of it, you know, it's up to them.
Now, this debt, the real debt crisis you're talking about, that'll be the consequence of all the inflation to make up for the next crash? Or that'll be the next crash?
I think that will be the cause of it, you know. And when I say crash, I don't think it's happening this year. Like, usually a crash is a culmination of a market already declining. Very rarely does it just, you know, next week it crashes and we just made a new high. Usually it's a panic event from people who are already losing lots of money and then they just can't take it anymore.
But like you said, though, the last time we had the crash of 08, everybody ran to government securities and propped those up.
Yeah,
you're saying
did.
That won't work?
Yeah, I believe this time around that won't work. And that will be something unique in our lifetime. It actually happened in the Great Depression for a period of time. so, which is interesting comparison, but because what actually and I think there could be some similarities. What happened in the Great Depression in 1929 after the stock market crashed, it all rallied back up for 6 months or so, and then when it had the next leg down, interestingly enough, the bond market fell in the United States and across the world. Mm-hmm. And there was actually deflation in the United States in the first round of this drop, and this decline in the bond market is really what hurt U.S. banks and, you know, caused that famous banking crisis that happened.
And then we all know the history. World War II saved us from the Great Depression. No, I'm just kidding.
Sorry,
I got to go. I'm late.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
Thank you so much, Mike, for coming on the show, man. Appreciate it.
Great talking with you again.
Yeah, you too, man. Okay, guys, that is the great Mike Swanson. He wrote The War State, which is a great book that you'll love to read and give to your friends. And then also he does investment advice for you at wallstreetwindow.com.
Hey guys, this is Burden Carr from the Friends Against Government podcast here, and you've probably heard Scott talk about the crowdsourcing effort on Reddit about his upcoming book. All you got to do to get in is to donate $5 a month to Scott's Patreon and request to join the private Reddit group.
In Scott's Reddit group, you will find a pinned post outlining the details for how you can help find source material for Scott's upcoming book by listening to archived interviews and taking a few notes.
If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to either myself, at BirdArchist, or Carr, at CarrCampIt on Twitter, and we'll be happy to help.
We look forward to seeing you in there.
All right, y'all, thanks. Find me at LibertarianInstitute.org, at ScottHorton.org, Antiwar.com, and Reddit.com/ScottHortonShow. Oh yeah, and read my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan, at FoolsErrand.us.